It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And we are joined once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both co-editors at Eat the State. How are you both this morning?
Good.
You mean there's someone other than now?
What?
Most weeks it's none other than. It didn't happen this week. I'm kind of confused.
Well, your confusion, we've been wanting to talk to you about for a long time, Jav.
Yeah, no doubt.
But we don't have enough time in 30 minutes to cover that.
Yeah, and many of my employers as well have been kind of curious about that. I keep writing about things they just don't understand. But yeah, go ahead.
We'll not talk about the Seattle Weekly right now.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I thought we were gonna talk about Greg Pallas.
We should. I did do an interview of him that I'll be writing on in the Weekly next week. And for folks who missed the 7:30 interview, Greg is a reporter for The Guardian and BBC in Britain. He is an American, however, and has been doing mostly over here as well as internationally marvelous internet investigative reporting over the past several years, including a number of stories that, as it turns out, he was very prescient on. Has a new book out, is very articulate. It was on the 7:30 segment, and we'll be here in a couple of weeks, and people should definitely go and see him. We'll be down, it's the 22nd, he'll be down at the IMC in the afternoon and then at Town Hall in the evening. And we'll be on this show, too, live on the 7:30 segment on the 22nd. Tune in. I wound up talking with him for a couple, 3 hours at 1:30 in the morning because of the time zone difference. He's quite a guy, but it was very interesting because he and I came into I guess the world of journalism at the same time. We do somewhat different things, and obviously at a somewhat different level. I mean, I was a little bit self-conscious because, number one, I was didn't have a background in journalism. I came in my middle age, having done a number of other things, as did he, and was self-conscious because I came into a top 15 market, that being Seattle, in sort of a marquee job of being columnist, and lo and behold, he came in even higher than I did. And the sort of thing of feeling like your lack of training in journalism or in writing or reporting is an impediment, and actually it's not. It's a tremendous advantage, and we both kind of figured that out pretty quickly because you don't have the kind of blinders that people who have never been out in the real world, who've never had working class type jobs or even professional jobs, but jobs outside the newsroom instead of going to journalism school and being taught what to think and how to write and what stories to look for and not look for. And so you come in with kind of a fresh eye, and so much of investigative journalism, and I'm not an investigative journalist, even though I'm accused of it from time to time. I don't do that much work with source documents. I'll have some people feed it to me occasionally, and I certainly know what to do with it when I get it. That is an invitation, by the way. But it's really more the matter that most people in journalism and in media in this country aren't willing to ask questions. They're not willing to ask questions, particularly of people in power, particularly that might make people in power uncomfortable. And so you have all of these issues that we talk about in this segment every week also quite a bit, that don't get reported by a lot of mainstream media. And it's not because the information isn't out there and fairly easily available, and it's not because nobody can figure it out. It's because nobody is willing to rock the boat by inconveniencing what, in many cases, are their friends, are certainly their colleagues in terms of income and class interests and that kind of thing. And so the boat doesn't get rocked, and we're seeing in many ways also the same sorts of things with the revelations, and I know we're gonna talk a lot about this. And Greg was talking about it at 7:30, the whole apparatus with the national security state now, and the what did they know before 9/11, and the hearings that we're getting in Congress right now, and the issue is not what people didn't know or have the ability to know before 911. The issue is whether people were willing to inconvenience their friends, you know, in this case, either the Saudis through investigation of terror networks or the Enrons of the world and the big energy trading companies and many of the other corporations that were doing off-book accounting. It's not like the clues weren't all there. It's that people don't want to look. And it's a very corrupt way to run a society and run a government.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So that being said, people should go get his book because one of the wonderful things that Greg does is he does provide the source documents. And so, I mean, one of the things that happens to me certainly with the Weekly and Working Assets, and you know for darn sure it happens with Greg at the BBC and The Guardian, is the lawyers vet all this stuff. You know, they're very, very afraid in commercial media of getting sued. So once it gets onto that point, you know, it's no longer a conspiracy theory. It's been pretty well researched and double checked and documented and double documented. So the issue of Greg's material not being picked up and other places in the media is not a question of its accuracy or its authenticity. It's a question of will.
Okay, well, speaking of media, one of our favorite sources locally, the Seattle PI, I thought it must be a mistake that they finally got a headline right this week.
Bush, he's fired.
Bush unveils terror strategy.
There you go.
Oh my God, they're actually going to reveal the truth for once. But
yeah.
But it was something different.
No. No. In fact, I keep hearing in various places. I think on NPR this week I heard that this had to do with like the Egyptian president's trip here, Hosni Mubarak, that the Bush administration was still formulating its Mideast policy. And I heard that and I thought, I think it was Daniel Pinkwater said that. I heard that and I thought, you moron. The Bushies have had a Middle East strategy, and it's precisely to do nothing, which is, you know, will come up later.
Yeah, including with dictators like Mubarak and Musharraf and Pakistan and whatnot.
Exactly.
We prop them up. It's not that that we're occupied elsewhere.
We give them a little money, and then we sit back and let them do what they want, you know. But anyway, to talk about the counterterrorism roadshow, which is what Mike brought up. That's what I call it.
It's, and it has very little to do with terror.
It has very, very little to do with terror. Again, we're seeing it's a war on civil liberties and your right to privacy and freedom from unreasonable and random search and seizures. Just this week, the President Bush announced the new domestic security agency, which is now a cabinet post. But the interesting thing about that is that this is a plan that they've been developing for several months since 9/11, and they weren't going to announce it until this summer. And the reason they announced it, I think yesterday was when they announced it, or was it the day before?
A couple days ago.
Yeah,
the day before,
damage
I think.
Control.
Was because that was the same day Colleen Rowley and Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, were testifying before congressional investigative committees, and the Bush administration needed something to take them out of the news or to draw your attention away from them. And this plan, as Bush has announced it, is so vague and so sketchy. And I've looked at the 28-page document, which is amazing. I mean, for a major restructuring like this, they only have a 28-page document. It's very, very, very...
It's the longest thing that Bush could read.
I know. He probably hasn't even read it.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, he's notorious for not reading even two-page policy briefings, as we've come to find out. But Mike's laughing over there, but it's true. He doesn't read. But if you read the document, if you look at it, it's very, very sketchy.
By the way, it's a very, very close leap from doesn't to can't, but go on.
I know. But what the cabinet level agency will do is basically, from what I can tell, not very darn much. They're supposedly going to analyze data from the CIA and FBI, but they won't have access to raw data, which means they'll be looking at reports that the FBI and CIA have already put together and analyzed data and so forth. And they're going to, I guess, become the house for agencies like the Coast Guard and the Secret Service and the INS, et cetera. But it's all largely for show.
Yeah. In other words, it's yet another layer of bureaucracy in the get smaller government, get government off our backs crowd.
Yeah. At exactly the same time, Colleen Rowley was complaining that it's the layers of bureaucracy that are part of the problem. Now, what's not being reported is that Rowley is not talking about necessarily mid-level bureaucracy. She's talking about top bureaucracy and about policy decisions that made counterterrorism not an important thing to do in these past 2 years once John Ashcroft got into office. Janet Reno, just as she was leaving, was starting to put a big emphasis on counterterrorism, but as soon as Ashcroft got in, he switched the focus of the FBI from counterterrorism, going so far as to refuse funding for counterterrorism agents, for translators, for technology that would have allowed them to track people within the U.S. they thought might have connections to terrorism agencies or terrorism groups. Ashcroft's goal, when he got into office, was basically to put forward a social policy, and that social policy is to get rid of gun control, to put limits on abortion, to limit assisted suicide, to go after medical marijuana, to go after prostitution, to do a number of these social engineering type things, and he could have cared less about counterterrorism. But the interesting thing is that these congressional investigations, they're looking at George Tenet of the CIA, they're questioning Robert Mueller, head of the FBI, but no one is questioning Ashcroft or the people just below him who help him formulate policy. These are the people who are really to blame. It has, you know, really nothing to do with the lack of intelligence. We've had plenty of intelligence. It has nothing to do with lack of communication between the FBI and CIA. There's plenty of communication between the two. The problem is that it was just not made a priority.
Yeah,
and the person who didn't make it a priority is John Ashcroft.
Yeah, these have been entirely political decisions. And, you know, that's what I was leading toward with the comments when we started talking about Greg, that it really comes to trying to deflect attention from the Bush administration itself, from George W. Bush's appointees, and particularly John Ashcroft. And what we're seeing again with the counterterrorism roadshow or the counterterrorism hoax show is that Ashcroft is now using the ostensible goal of preventing terrorism as an excuse for furthering his social agendas yet again.
Exactly.
So that, for example, we had the announcement this week that 200,000 people from over two dozen countries around the world that come to the United States are going to be fingerprinted either when they come into the country, if they do come in. That's about 100,000 a year. And then there's 100,000 who are already here who are going to be required to be fingerprinted. And then all of these people are supposed to report their movements at all times. Well, a couple things about that. Number one, I'm not entirely sure what good fingerprints are going to do at the scene of a suicide bombing. You know, we're gonna uncover 45,000 billion tons of rubble at the World Trade Center looking for a couple fingerprints, so they're scattered about a mile and a half apart, so we can figure out what happened to the one suicide bomber already know who they are.
And better yet, would this whole system have stopped Timothy McVeigh? If they had fingerprinted and made him report every 3 to 12 months, you know.
We could certainly do the same program to ex-military and have a much higher chance of finding actual sociopaths, because people who volunteer for the Army, I mean, you know, it's selects for them.
It wouldn't stop them from doing what they want.
No, not at all. and the additional point to that is, though, that the actual people who are planning on wreaking havoc to whatever they are. I mean, are they going to be the ones who tell the FBI where they're going to be at all times? Are they the ones that are going to report for their fingerprints? Of course not. I mean, it is exactly the same logic that people like Ashcroft rail against around gun control. Remember the whole thing about guns, you know, when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns? Well, I mean, the idea behind that is that if you criminalize gun ownership, which very few people have ever talked about, but if you go along with that red herring for a moment. If you do that, then the people, the criminals, whose hands you want to keep them out of, will be the last people to go along with it. Well, of course, it's the same thing with somebody who plans to commit mass murder, wouldn't you think? So it really has very little to offer in terms of being an effective actual tool to prevent terrorist attacks. What it can do is a form of social control and setting a further precedent for keeping an eye on everybody.
And it'll tie in nicely with the Thriftway's fingerprinting system.
But what it will do, and it'll do a couple things, anyone who's had to spend any time with the Immigration and Naturalization Service knows how terribly inefficient it is, how slow it is, how hard it is to get your documents processed. It'll slow that down probably by a factor of 2 to 3. It'll make it much longer.
And don't forget that the INS is one of the agencies that's going to be folded into this big new super cabinet department also. So it's going to become even more inefficient.
Right. And the other thing it'll do, and Ashcroft has said this, that he's refusing to let anybody in the public know what criteria they're going to use for selecting people to be fingerprinted and photographed and so forth. What it will do is it will allow it's a form of racial profiling. I mean, it will allow the government to select people based on their nationality and or their ethnicity and or their religion to keep them out
or political beliefs.
Yeah, or without any sort of public scrutiny. I mean, this is a democracy. There shouldn't be anything in a democracy that is secret from the public. And in particular, you shouldn't have anything that allows the government to select people based on very sketchy and very general and very vague terms like this will do. So that's the other thing. It is not just a form of social engineering. It's a form of discrimination.
Yeah.
Very severe form of discrimination.
And not only is it a form of discrimination as well, but bear in mind, you have to combine this with the realization that for non-citizens, not only is the government going to very aggressively collect information based on people's religion, based upon their political beliefs, based upon their gender, based upon certainly their nationality, but they now have the right to indefinitely imprison them, to deport them to despotic regimes where they will be, in many cases, assassinated immediately
by
the secret police.
Another Ashcroft innovation.
Yeah, simply because, you know, they have been deported and therefore they're probably, you know, terrorists according to some of these dictatorial regimes. So, you know, you have the ability for the government not only to collect all this information and demand all of these police state type steps for people, but you combine that with throwing them into jail and or essentially condemning them to death as a result of the information the government is collecting. Very, very frightening stuff. And there is absolutely nothing that certainly in the rationales that are being put forward for this to prevent somebody like Ashcroft from expanding that program down the line to people like you and I.
Yeah, to domestic surveillance and detaining people who he believes are terrorism risks, but they happen also to be U.S. citizens and were born U.S. citizens.
Yeah, and you if that sounds like crazy talk, bear in mind that other so-called democracies that we admire and that in fact we're pitching some of our counterterrorism steps from places like Britain with rule in the troubles in Northern Ireland, places like Israel have had indefinite detainment of citizens for many years, and you know, can certainly happen here.
Well, speaking of things that should be out in the open, I find it kind of disturbing that a lot of these investigations, congressional investigations into 911, are happening behind closed doors.
Yeah, those should be out in the open, too. We should be able to see and read the transcripts and find out what exactly they're undercover, what exactly they're uncovering. You know, I mean, there's nothing about this that should be secret.
Yeah, it seems the accountability here lies with the American people and getting the information out to who the democracy is serving.
There's actually a couple of other things that are kind of happening in secret that have gone unreported in the media or reported in only one or two places. One of them is a massive CIA expansion. This is being done on the quiet. I've looked at a figure that says that the CIA wants to triple their number of field officers in the next 2 years. They're also doing away with a 1995 rule that has prevented field officers from recruiting human rights abusers. This rule was put in place when Jennifer Harbury's husband, Ephraim, Bamaka?
Yeah,
was murdered.
Happened several months ago.
Yeah. No.
It's been made permanent.
Oh, yeah. The repealing of the rule. It's going to allow field officers, which are going to be expanding in number threefold, to recruit drug dealers, murderers, torturers, butchers, kidnappers, rapists, a number of human rights abusers, and they're not going to have to tell the central office or get an okay from the central office. And this is sheer opportunism, as we've seen from these congressional investigations, a little bit that's leaked out to us that we know. There's been no lack of intelligence on terrorist organizations.
Yeah.
We have the knowledge. There's even been pretty good discussion between the FBI and CIA. It's just been a lack of will to follow up on the leads. This is just sheer opportunism. It's allowing the agency to go back to its old habits of assassinations and setting up coups and just allowing them wider powers. They're chafing under this restriction from Jennifer Harbury's case that has kept them from recruiting human rights abusers.
Yeah, they're friends, basically. And, mm-hmm. and in many cases, they feel like those people who've demonstrably committed those things, I mean, those aren't impediments. Those are considered job qualifications in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as though, you know, intelligence capability doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work isn't because, as Maria was saying, we don't have the intelligence. It's because we don't do... We don't. There are human beings interpreting the intelligence, and that can suffer from bad interpretation. It can suffer from lack of communication, and it can especially suffer from lack of a political will or lack of willingness to see the things that we do not want to see.
Mm-hmm.
There was a hilarious quote. It was from, I think, one of the senators at one of the hearings yesterday, who was blasting Ashcroft's new proposal with the fingerprinting and reporting of location program, talking about, you know, we're going to be the CIA is not only trying to expand its field capabilities threefold, but they're particularly emphasizing Arabic, Central Asian languages, mm-hmm. Southeast Asian language, South Asian, that whole part of the world. So there was this priceless quote, something along the line of, we're going to be inviting them to job fairs in the morning and then fingerprinting them in the afternoon. I mean, you know, it's just sort of counterproductive here.
Exactly. Exactly. There's another thing being done on the quiet, too. The Transportation Security Administration, the folks who are supposed to be responsible for searching people at airports before they get on airplanes and so forth, they now want to check your credit history and purchasing data before you get on board an airplane for your flight. Now, we talked about this some last week when we talked about the FBI now wanting to scan commercial databases who collect data on purchasing activity for marketing and for companies to target folks for advertising. This $45 million project will allow the Transportation Security Administration and the FBI to scan property records, driver's license info, telephone listings, and your purchase histories. So if you buy too much pita bread, you eat too much pita bread or too much hummus or something, you're gonna throw up a red flag for them, and they may not let you board your airplane. Now,
I don't know. I could see that as not for that example, but a good thing for people like executives at Enron. If they'd had their credit rating checked, you know, they wouldn't have been galloping around
Actually, the country in the business class section. I think they had all the credit cards they wanted.
I think so,
that's
too.
That's probably not a problem. But combine that also, if you remember, immediately after 9/11, we were getting these scattered reports from around the country of people who were flagged and then in some cases not allowed to board airplanes because their name was some on some or another list, and people were claiming that they were on some or another list because of their political activities. Well, those sorts of reports have continued to pop up, whether or not people couldn't get on the plane, but people overhearing things like, well, I got a hit on the FBI list that this person was a terrorist. In fact, there was a guy at a who was arrested at a demonstration in Colorado Springs about 2 weeks ago, a guy named Bill Salt, who was part of a group that was leafleting outside an appearance by Rumsfeld in front of the Air Force Academy. They were arrested, a place where they normally legally leaflet all the time because, well, Rumsfeld was coming and they didn't want him to see these people. And, you know, they were released after a while. They just wanted to get them out of the way. But while he was sitting in the patrol car, you know, hearing we got a hit on this guy as belonging to a terrorist organization. Well, you know, that terrorist organization could be, you know, Citizens for Peace in Space or War Resisters League or Peace Action or whatever.
Anti-globalization organization.
But the fact is that they are also keeping and sharing with the Transportation Security Administration these kind of names as well, people whose names they are collecting on the basis of their political beliefs. And, you know,
know, you add up all of these different red flags. I mean, you know, we're not talking about just one different thing that should be causing people for concern. We've mentioned about 15 of them in the last half hour alone, any one of which should be a red flag that we're sliding toward a police state that and wants to control people's political beliefs.
And the important thing is that these are not for your safety. These things are not for the safety of anyone.
All.
For example, this proposal for the Transportation Administration to have this data is not to protect people getting on airplanes. It's to stop the random searches that they're doing because airlines think that it's driving away their business class customers. They're having a hard time selling their business class seats, which make up about 2/3 of their revenue, and they want to stop the random searches. So because airlines want business clients, some guy in a 3-piece suit, some Enron executive to fly on their airline, you're going to have to let the airlines or to let the National Transportation Safety Administration look at your credit history and this very, very private information about you.
Yeah, they're setting up a couple programs. One is sort of similar to one they have at the border where, you know, if they have your information on your hand all along, that you'll fly right through without being searched. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're Al-Qaeda, you just bribe one of these Enron officials because you know they can be bribed. And there's that kind of syndrome. And, there's a class-based differentiation going on there too, but you know, above and beyond that, all of these losses of personal freedoms of government singling people out based on their ethnicity or their political beliefs or their credit history or whatever it is. Anytime you have any of these kind of abuses in places that we do recognize as police states, as authoritarian regimes, dictatorships, communist states, and so forth, it is invariably done in the name of national security. It's to root out criminals. It's to protect us all from the bad guys. And people don't object, even in places like Soviet Russia, you know, where life went on more or less under a communist regime for 80 years. People don't object, 70 years, whatever it was, because it happens to a minority of the population. And as long as you keep your head down and look the other way, you know, you don't have to worry about it.
I want to jump back to a sec before we run out of time about talk about Colleen Rowley for a second. Mm-hmm. And the big issue to me that the media is missing, they're just focusing on that she's saying that they need to change their structure that is too, you know, top heavy and whatever. They seem to totally have missed the point that in her letter, which we've only seen part of, Time Magazine had mm-hmm. several pages of it, that she specifically pointed out some person in the middle that was blocking the Minneapolis investigation repeatedly multiple times, and she pointed out, she never mentioned who the person was, but she said what the job was, and then she said, and 2 months after September 11th, after this person had been blocking things, this person was promoted into a major D.C. position. So I'd like to know why the heck the rest of the media isn't getting on who the heck was this person, and why aren't we getting some spotlight on him?
And who promoted him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, who gave that decision?
Exactly.
Yeah. Again, you know? it's this lack of interest in asking questions of powerful people.
All right. We only, just real quickly, there was one other thing, too, to mention. Marie said the Washington State ferries are going to be doing something.
Yeah, the Washington State Patrol has been randomly searching cars who want to get on the ferry. And they say it's completely voluntary. But the problem with it is if you refuse to let them search your car, maybe you've got a doobie under the seat or something, they will tell the captain of the ferry boat, and he has the right and has done this, refused to let you get on the ferry with your car. So you have to wait for the next one.
It's sort of like,
or you have to drive.
It's sort of like the voluntary right to take a breathalyzer test, you know, or you get, yeah, it's once again, Fourth Amendment unreasonable search and seizure seems to be in tatters at the moment.
Right now, the local ACLU office wants to hear from people who have refused and been refused to get on the ferry, or people who have had to submit to the search and didn't like it. So there may be a suit in the offering, so you should look them up if that's happened to you.
And they are in the phone book.
They are in the phone book.
Yep.
All right. Well, with that, we are pretty much running out of time for this week. Talking again with Jov Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And what exactly, again, is Eat the State?
It is a 5-course meal, actually going towards 6, 7, and 8, given the way the state's powers are expanding. It's a wonderful little community newspaper, free of charge every couple of weeks, and put out almost entirely by volunteers. We pay our layout guy a little bit because, well, he needs the money. We depend on volunteers for our writing, for our distribution, for, you know, all kinds of things. So please help out. You can also find us on the web. It's at www.eatthestate.org.
all one word, .org. And we also take tips and stories and feedback and all that kind of thing at our voicemail, which is area code 206-903-9461.
All right, and real quickly, any events going on today that we need to plug?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
And you can
why?
Start.
Do you want to know any of them? Yeah, it's there's a the Middle East, of course, has continued to be a hot spot. The Israelis are continuing to go into camps and into Palestinian cities on the West Bank, even though we're not hearing about it as much in the news. It's continuing to happen, and it is the 35th anniversary today, I believe, of the illegal military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So there is a in the occupation now march and rally happening at 1 o'clock at Westlake in downtown Seattle.
Very good. All right, so are you both back next week?
Yes.
Yes, we are.
Very
yes.
good. And we will talk to you then.
Great.
Okay.